This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hi, welcome to All in the Mind. I'm Lynn Malcolm. This week, the psychology of stalking.
I've never been so frightened in my life. The funny things were like thinking, I'm in a spy movie, I'm being followed. So you go another way to try and throw off the... And you think, what am I doing this for? And it was... But it was so awful, so bizarre.
That's Carol remembering the terrifying experience of being stalked. It's the stuff of thrillers on the silver screen, for sure. But sadly, it can be a harsh reality for some. Stalking is characterised by imposing on someone else repeated unwanted communication and contact, which can cause extreme distress and fear. It hasn't always been known by that term, but accounts from law courts in London in the 18th and 19th centuries clearly describe this insidious behaviour. But according to Professor Paul Mullen of the Victorian Institute of Forensic Mental Health, stalking is becoming more prevalent.
My guess is it's becoming far more frequent over the last 10, 20 years, and that's what's pushed it into prominence. But also partly chance. Media in particular became interested with those who pursued, constantly intruded on, and occasionally attacked the famous, the so-called star stalkers. And this group got a lot of publicity, and that's really where the name stalking began and where the studies began. I mean, one of the best portrayals of stalking that we have in art was a film which was produced before we even had the word stalking, and that was Play Misty for me. But once we began to publicise and start to understand the people who pursued the famous, it became increasingly clear that this was just the tip of an iceberg, a very large and sinister iceberg, which involved far wider sections of the community than just the famous.
Today, we hear Carol's story. It's not her real name, and her voice has been changed to protect her identity. She was a tertiary education teacher, and she was stalked over a period of 3 years by one of her students. As a result, her and her family's life was severely disrupted. And even though it happened 15 years ago, the fear she felt then is still palpable. And the whole thing seemed to come out of the blue for her.
Well, this person was in my class, and at the end of the course, he rang me up and said, "Now I'm not in your class anymore, we can go out together." And I just said, what do you mean? It was just a shock, because you don't realise that he had sat in my class and developed this obsession without knowledge of me, and he had a whole world in his head.
But you wouldn't have realised at that stage that it was an obsession.
No. Well, yeah, I'm saying, sorry, no, I'm in a relationship, I'm not interested, That was it as far as I was concerned. But then it was several times he just kept ringing and ringing. I never even had a social event with this person, never had a coffee, nothing. It was always a teacher-student relationship in a classroom. But he wouldn't take no.
And what else did he do besides ring?
Well, I mean, I solved the ringing by getting an unlisted phone number. But then it started with postcards, and I would get about 3 a week. And they would always have been posted at the same time every day. And it was always, "You sure you don't want to see me? I'd love to see you, da da da." And I got letters, copious pages of letters explaining how he wanted to be part of my family and how he wanted a relationship with me. And he also used to send flowers. He used to have bouquets of flowers arrive. I only sent a couple of replies saying as strongly as I could, "Do not contact me. I do not want a relationship with you. Go away."
Did he respond to that?
No.
Did he ever follow you?
Yes, that was what started to happen next. He would be waiting outside my house, which then used to stop me from going out sometimes. But if you have to go to work, you have to buy things from the supermarket. And he would follow me in his vehicle. And I found that absolutely terrifying. I used to sometimes go via the police station and dash out and tell the police, look, I'm being followed. And of course they'd come out and he's not there. Because he would also start hanging about outside work and he wouldn't be there. So I'd drive home and I'd be thinking, is he going to be at the other end?
As Carol experienced, stalking can involve all sorts of contact. And these days, emails and SMS messages have added another dimension. Forensic psychiatrist Paul Mullen and his team spent the last decade studying stalking. They've interviewed hundreds of victims and perpetrators.
It's associated with sending gifts from the innocuous chocolates to the far from innocuous coffins, pigs' heads, etc. Dead pets, subscriptions to pornographic magazines, underwear with little notes about how they're hoping to see you in this, etc., etc., etc. Right across the whole gamut of the odd and the ordinary. Ordering or cancelling goods on a person's behalf, typically pizzas in the middle of the night. It's associated with threats, and perhaps most importantly, it's associated with both physical and sexual violence.
Can you always assume that it will lead on to violence?
No. That being said, out there in the community, somewhere between 5 and 10% of people who are stalked are going to be assaulted, and a number of them are going to be assaulted seriously. And if we look at it the other way around, what proportion of serious sexual and physical violence is preceded by stalking? Well, a significant proportion is. So there is a very real association between stalking and threats and violence. It's not trivial, but it's far from universal.
So how long does it typically go on for once it's defined as stalking? I guess there's a fine line there between harassment and stalking.
Absolutely. Essentially, there are two groups of stalkers. There are the short-term harassers and stalkers who typically stalk for a few days, typically pick on strangers, they typically follow, approach, try and engage the person in conversation, and occasionally repeatedly SMS or phone. This tends to stop relatively rapidly and the stalking ends. The other group is much more long-term stalking. If a stalker persists for more than 2 weeks, the chances are they're going to persist for at least 6 to 12 months. Which of the two are violent? Well, as you might expect, the ones who become violent are the long-term stalkers. About 50% of stalkers are the brief harassers, and about 50% are the long-term real problems.
It's the uncertainty, because he would come, it seemed, when he could. And in fact, he used to say that in his letters, I'm working so-and-so, I won't be there. This is, you try not to read them, but on the other hand, you feel you have to because you need to know, because he did make threats as well about coming round.
Violence?
Yes, violence to himself.
Did he ever threaten suicide?
Yeah, And that he would come and do it outside my door. That is a worst fear, that he's going to do something to himself in front of me. But it's when, it's where. It was really the fear of the unknown.
Was there a sense that you felt sorry for him in any way because you couldn't return this incredible feeling?
No, I felt just revulsion. I did not feel I wanted to have anything to do with him. I did, however, recognise that he was ill.
About 10% have a serious mental disorder. Though they don't have serious mental illness, very few people who stalk are exactly well-balanced individuals. They tend to be people who have difficulty with relationships, either the rather inadequate, shy, dependent types, or they tend to be the sort of arrogant, demanding individuals, very sensitive to their own rights and insensitive to the rights and prerogatives of others. Difficult characters, but they're not actually mentally ill, most of them.
In order to better understand stalking, Paul Mullen's group have categorised people who stalk according to what motivates them. There's the rejected stalker, usually ex-partners trying to reinstate a relationship.
The intimacy seeker, who professes love but is oblivious to their victim's feelings. And people who stalk celebrities usually fall into this category and are the most persistent. There's the incompetent suitor, who lacks the social skills necessary to establish an intimate relationship. The resentful stalker, who's motivated by anger and a desire for revenge. They can be very frightening, but rarely physically violent. And lastly, and thankfully the most rare, the predatory stalker. They're driven by sadistic pleasure. Their stalking is sexual in nature and often leads to attack. As you can imagine, Paul Mullen and his colleagues have come across some bizarre stories in their line of work.
All different stalkers can sometimes convince those around them that, in fact, their beliefs are correct. So we had one odd young man who'd become quite convinced that someone he really had no connection with whatsoever would be his future bride, that they were destined for each other, that he loved her, so naturally she must love him. The family were always worried about this young man. They thought he'd never find anyone, he'd never really managed to find a girlfriend, and they were so delighted when he told them that he was engaged to be married, that they arranged the wedding, and they even went round with this young man to serenade the girl he was to marry. They all stood outside of her house, the whole family, it was quite a large family actually, singing and bringing gifts, which was somewhat distressing to the poor girl, who really didn't know who this bloke was, other than he was a strange man who'd been following her and sending her unwanted bunches of flowers.
Another strategy that he had was to go to various counsellors and psychiatrists, or even people that he'd seen me go to their houses or meet. He would contact them and say, you know, this person, she's being so cruel to me, can you bring us together? You know, couldn't you just ring for me and perhaps arrange a meeting? And, you know, I know she wants to, really. And so I would get this phone call and I would say, I don't know what he's told you, but, you know, and then I gave my side of the story. And, you know, in that case, they just said, oh, right. Then I'd never hear from that one again. So he would obviously move on to the next one. And when it happened and it was, say, a friend of mine he'd approached, I would just say, look, whose side are you on? You know, why did you listen to him? But he obviously was very persuasive.
Stalking causes terrible psychological damage. In essence, victims are deprived of their freedom and can become deeply depressed. Carol was lucky that her workplace was supportive and they paid for her to go to a psychiatrist for help.
He was fantastic, but he gave me no hope. He said, he is not going to change, so what are you going to do about it? And he said, what do you do when he's there? I said, I just run away. I just move very quickly away. He said, no, what you must do is you stop and you say something to him. A negative statement and then something that he should go and do. And so I had all these little phrases ready to say. So I would say, I'm too old for you. I mean, he was almost 20 years my junior. Go and find a girlfriend your own age. I used to have to grit my teeth to do it, and I honestly don't know if it helped. But I think it mostly was just an overriding fear.
It's still obviously very upsetting for you so many years later. How has it affected you?
It has affected me. In fact, I don't know how film stars stand it. They have to stay where they are, so they get bodyguards and things like that. But I was just an ordinary person. I had to do something about it. I moved house. I changed my name. I changed my job. And basically, the whole of my life changed as a result of it. And I changed too. I became, and I think I still am, a very private person. I value my friends. I had nightmares for many years about the following. That is just the most terrifying thing.
So it was like revisiting the following
year? Yes, yes. Nightmares. The panic. I don't have nightmares. I didn't have preparing for this either, which I felt that was good. I used to have fear when I was in my car and saw another vehicle like his. I don't have that anymore. And I think I have repressed a lot. I think it made me recognise that I'm quite a strong person, but it did change my life.
You're listening to All in the Mind on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, and perhaps on your MP3 player. I'm Lynn Malcolm, exploring the psychology of stalking. I'm speaking with Carol, though it's not her real name, and her voice has been disguised. Did you have a sense that people fully believed you?
Yes, I think they, you know, they think, oh, how amazing, you know, that someone's got an obsession, but they always want to know, you know, well, did you ever go out with him? Did you ever? And I said, never. Never even had a coffee with him. But you have to keep explaining it. Mm. And that was a strange thing.
Being stalked can engender complex and confusing emotions. Forensic psychologist Rosemary Purcell works with Paul Mullen and has treated many stalking victims.
Because stalking is kind of insidious, it's a prolonged form of victimisation, and so it really does lend itself to people questioning their own behaviour. And it's absolutely crucial to keep in mind that this is always something that a stalker chooses to do. They're imposing this behaviour on the victim, so they shouldn't incorporate any blame themselves. And certainly there'll be a number of people that will actively blame the victim for their encounter. And the most obvious is where it's an ex-partner that's engaging in the stalking. Very common for people to say, well, you made your bed, you sleep in it. Very, very damaging behaviours to try and put this back on the victim.
Is that ex-partner situation a common one?
It is. Roughly about a third of cases involve an ex-intimate partner. Predominantly, it's interestingly men pursuing their female ex-partners. That's certainly potentially the most dangerous as well. They can know exactly what the victim's daily movements are, obviously where they work, who they interact with. So they've got a lot of information at their disposal that they can use against the victim.
And some of the strategies that they might use, I presume they will appeal to the victim for the victim to feel sorry for them?
Mm-hmm. Yep. One of the classics, I guess, is the last ditch kind of meeting. So I just need to meet with you one more time and get a bit of closure on this and then I'll stop. You won't see me again. And I'm not aware of any case where that's actually been a genuine offer by a stalker. These are all attempts to try and maintain any level of relationship with the victim, even if it's a dysfunctional one. And in some terrible instances, the stalker can sometimes resort to threatening self-harm and suicide. So if you don't see me again, this is the action that I'm going to take. And now that's a dreadful situation to be placed in, but essentially it's the last ditch effort again to try and bring the victim back into their world. And as much as possible, once the person has conveyed that they feel they're being stalked and they want the behaviour to end, all contact has to end with that. It's the key way to actually resolving the situation.
So some of the temptations must be, say, if the stalker sends them gifts or letters in the mail, you'd be inclined to just send them back, or mm-hmm. if the stalker is out there waiting, you'd be inclined to yell at them to go away. I mean, there must be behaviour that inadvertently you're feeding the stalker with.
Oh, absolutely, and stalkers frequently send unwanted material in the mail, and the immediate response is return to sender. And while that seems fairly innocuous, it's still implicitly communicating with the stalker. So even very subtle things like that, we try to educate, I guess, the victim as to how the stalker perceives these behaviours. And certainly with the case of materials being sent, people should hang on to it for no other reason than it's potentially evidence that this person is stalking you. But it's very difficult for victims to move back from the situation and have no contact, because unfortunately it feels a very passive way of dealing with what's a very intrusive situation in their lives. But it really can be the most powerful remedy for this.
Rosemary Purcell has also come across a number of instances of false accusations of stalking. Most of them weren't malicious, often connected with paranoia associated with mental illness. But there's a small percentage of people who knowingly make false claims.
Interestingly, one instance where we see this is where the stalker preempts that the victim is going to get police help, for example, and so they claim to be the victim themselves, which just muddies the whole water and can cause a nightmare situation for the victim. And there are a number of instances where courts would recommend, for example, that the parties take out mutual intervention orders against one another. And I think that's a strategy that we have to be very, very wary of, because some stalkers will actually be cunning enough to try and trick the victim into breaching an order, which then just causes more and more chaos and potentially criminal difficulties for the victim. So we need to be very careful of just how cunning and damaging a situation this can sometimes be.
The number of stalking complaints has risen sharply in recent years. For example, between 1995 and 2001, complaints in Victoria rose by almost 300%. So, what aspects of contemporary society may be contributing to this phenomenon? Professor Paul Mullen.
We now live in a society of serial monogamy. People move in and out of relationships, particularly in their teens and 20s. And every time any intimate relationship of any seriousness ends, there's a risk that one partner is going to be really very upset about this. And that then, if they have the right or the wrong characteristics, may lead to stalking. So that very dependent individuals and occasionally very narcissistic, arrogant individuals are just not going to accept someone else ending the relationship. The next thing, I think, is the resentful stalkers. There's a lot of people who find coping with the complexities of the work environment, the nature of modern society, very difficult. They're told they have a whole mass of rights, and, you know, they have a right for this and a right to that and a right to t'other. But, in fact, they find that they remain powerless and find it very difficult to actually cope with what they see as injustice and what they see as rejection and humiliation. And this group will take the law into their own hands in a way and try and wreak revenge on the doctor who's disappointed them, the lawyer who they feel has cheated them, the bank manager who's refused the mortgage, the man next door who won't move his rubbish, etc., etc., etc. So we see people acting from a sense of injustice and beginning to get into stalking to strike back at those they blame for their own problems. The other group we see is the incompetent suitors. There's a lot of lonely, incompetent men out there who in the old days used to be fixed up by their relatives, but not no longer. When I was a lad, when I went to dances, my mother and my aunt would insist I took one of my less socially able cousins with me, and everyone else had to take their less socially able relays, and you sort of fix them up with each other. But it's certainly all of the social mechanisms which used to ensure that the less socially able actually finished up with partners have broken down. And so you got lots of unfortunate young men out there harassing even less fortunate women. So most of the stalking out there is men pursuing women.
So what does
that say? And
that,
of course, tells us something. I think it tells us that one of the things you have to look for is the change in the role of women in our society, which most of us welcome, but some men find it difficult to cope with relationships which have any approximation to equality. I mean, I think there are a lot of aspects about the changing role of women which would produce problems for some men who then resort to stalking.
Paul Mullen, after 3 years of fear and torment, Carol's ordeal was finally taken in hand by the authorities.
What really brought it to a head finally was because he started to contact my workplace. He would phone up, and so, of course, the steps I took was I never took a phone call. So it had to go via other people in order to reach me and would get screened out. But he started coming on work premises, and he then made threats to my employer. And that, I have nothing but grateful thanks to my employer for the assistance. They did step in and said to the police, you must do something about this. This is an employee. She's being harassed by this person. You must do something. And finally, I say the police did take action. And so there was an arrest and there was a case.
And now that stalking is acknowledged as a criminal activity, what does this say about the way our society is now starting to see relationships, particularly between men and women?
Oh, the criminalisation of stalking was a very important step forward. And once you make it illegal, you can do two things. One, you can protect the victims, and secondly, you can help the perpetrators, because it gives the chance, once people are brought before the courts, to actually get them properly assessed and treated. Although many of them are not, only a small number are actually mentally ill, most of them can be helped with psychological techniques and with intensive counselling to actually alter their patterns of behaviour and perhaps improve some of their interpersonal and social skills.
He was told that that's what he had to do, get medical help. But I was also told, which I found not good news, is that he probably won't stop his behaviour. He may not do it to you again, but he is very likely to do it to someone else.
Thankfully, serial stalkers are the exception rather than the rule. But what further research is needed into stalking behaviour? Forensic psychologist Rosemary Purcell.
We're starting now to look at adolescent stalkers, just to get a handle on what sort of factors may contribute to this behaviour. There are a number of theories as to why people stalk, but it really hasn't actually been tested to understand, you know, is this a product of some sort of childhood experiences, or is it that they're just not learning with their initial relationships and interactions what the give and take is? So we're currently conducting a study on that here in Victoria. Many people don't believe that young people and adolescents stalk, which is again very, very damaging if it's a young person subjected to this behaviour, but we're able to look through the children's court, so we hope to certainly develop community awareness that this can happen to anyone, irrespective of age or gender, but really looking at what some of the factors are, and if we can intervene early, are we stemming a lot of forms of interpersonal violence, not just stalking, but maybe forms of domestic violence as well.
Do you think you ever got an understanding about why he became so obsessed? What was the essence of that?
I don't know. I don't know who knows the answer to that. I mean, I think he didn't have a happy childhood, but, you know, I don't think you can speculate. I think what you realise is that we live so much of the world in our heads, and people who develop these obsessions, you know, their fantasies are the world they live in, not the real world.
Thanks to Carol for sharing her experiences today, and she's now giving support to other victims of stalking. Paul Mullen and Rosemary Purcell, along with Michelle Pathay, have written a book called Stalkers and Their Victims, and it's published by Cambridge University Press. Today's program was produced by Pauline Newman with sound engineer Jenny Parsonage. And don't forget, you can catch up with this and our most recent programs via podcast. Go to our website at abc.net.au/rn and choose All in the Mind in the program list, where you'll also find further information and transcripts of our shows. I'm Lynn Malcolm. Next week on All in the Mind, an insight into the experience of hearing voices that others can't hear. It's more common than you think, and there's a growing movement to help people manage the voices in their head. Join me then.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. and we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.